Okay, Rolando.
What is up?
Did you know that Henry James's novella, The Turn of the Screw, has been adapted like over 20 times for movies and television?
I don't even know who that is or what that is.
Henry James is known for other books such as, you might know some of his other works. He also wrote Daisy Miller, The Bostonians, and The American. You may or may not. Henry James isn't one of those that we get to read a lot in high school or anything.
Does it sound like it?
But I mean, this novella has been widely impactful for film and television. Also, it's been turned into a radio drama, into an opera, into a Broadway play, into a chamber opera. And most recently, into a Netflix series. Yeah, seriously. It's definitely one of the most lauded, haunted books or pieces about hauntings, I think, that ever existed. So out of all of these adaptations, including this 2020 film, The Turning, we're going to not focus on that. We're actually going to focus on two very different yet very similar adaptations of The Turn of the Screw. We're going to focus on the 1961 film, The Innocents, based on the 1950 Broadway play also.
Okay.
And this new Netflix miniseries, which is the latest installment in the haunting franchise that Netflix is going to have. The Haunting of Bly Manor.
I think because it is part of a series, it no longer qualifies as a miniseries.
Yeah, it's an anthology series.
I think it's just, yes, that's more. The Haunting anthology series by Mike Flanagan.
By Mike Flanagan, who we have covered before in our The Shining and Dr. Sleep episode. Uh-huh. So
yes,
and we might possibly do The Haunting of Hill House, something we didn't get to before, but if there's a demand for it. So without any further ado, I am Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast
about unoriginality.
So everyone, so before we begin though, talking about all the spooky stuff, because we are in the spooky season, I do have some business to attend to, and that is, you guys need to give us more ratings on iTunes because we give you great content and we deserve it.
So if you enjoy this podcast and you want more, find us on iTunes and rate us. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. You can just find us with our handle, Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals, or just shoot us an email because we do love to hear from you guys.
And now, on to the spooky season. My first question for you is, did you know... Mm-hmm. Bly Manor was coming out on Netflix.
I did know.
Okay.
My girlfriend's a big fan of The Haunting of Hill House, so she was widely anticipating it.
Got it.
And it wasn't until we were halfway through episode one that I was like, this is an awful lot like a movie I saw once. And that's when I put it together. Mm-hmm. The movie that I'm, of course, referring to is 1961's The Innocents. We're not going to talk too much about the book. Mainly because we haven't read it. And mainly because we're here just to talk about the film and television properties.
I mean, we're so uneducated, so.
But just some basic facts about it. It's a horror novella, which is a shorter book than a novel. It came out in 1898. It was first introduced as a serial, which is, you know, portions of it and chapters were published in newspapers. Uh-huh. It is classified as both gothic fiction and ghost story. Henry James is not a stranger to ghost stories. He actually wrote many short stories that fit both of those genres, some of which will come into play a little later in the episode. And basically, this book is about a governess who comes to care for two children at a remote estate, Bly Manor. And throughout the course of the book and the way that the children are behaving and things that she finds out about the past, she comes to believe that the place is haunted and that the children are being possessed.
Can I just tell you how much I love that word, governess?
Governess, yeah.
Governess, yeah. Like, it's such a, like, we need more of those in our world. I mean, obviously only the rich people could afford governesses. Governess. Well, you only get one.
But yeah, the one thing that, you know, if you do some research about this book, The Turn of the Screw, is that there's a lot of speculation about what the book is actually about. And a lot of people kind of are divided on whether or not there's actual haunting in the book or not.
Is The Turn of the Screw like a reference to like a screw loose, like going crazy?
The expression, the turn of the screw.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, so it means an action that makes a bad situation worse. Especially one that forces someone to do something.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Puts a lot of things
that makes a lot of sense.
And yeah, for the novel. Thank you, Eddie Z. Producer Eddie Z is with us today.
All right. So an action that makes things worse. Well, that sums up this book and this movie.
I don't know about the book, but I can tell you from the movie. This
from
is
the movie
true.
For sure. So this book, widely influential, was adapted for, like we said, a bunch of stuff starting really early in the 20th century. And in 1950, it was made into a Broadway play, and it was written by William Archibald. And they decided to take this and adapt it into a film. And they had William Archibald write the script. And then Jack Clayton, who at that point had done this great British film called The Room at the Top and would go on to make other great British films that are really not as well known as they should be and all have to do with sexual repression.
Ooh.
That's like a big theme in a lot of his films. He was not happy with the script because he thought that William Archibald was leaning towards one way more than he was the other. And
the
he
paranormal.
Wanted. Yes, it was leaning more towards the paranormal, and he wanted it to be way more ambiguous. So he actually hired Truman Capote to come in and finesse the script.
No way!
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. So the movie that we're talking about, The Innocents, had Truman Capote's hand in it?
Yes.
I did not know that. That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, and okay. Truman Capote is known for writing Breakfast at Tiffany's and In Cold Blood and just being a very famous writer.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. Yeah.
Wait, he wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's?
He wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's, the book.
Oh.
The movie is very different from the book.
Okay. I gotcha. Okay, I'm a very...
very different.
You caught me off guard on that, but I was just like, how is that not a known fact?
Yeah. It's, yeah. So, I think he distanced himself from the film. So directed by Jack Clayton, the governess in this film, her name is Miss Giddens, and she is played by Deborah Kerr, who people might know from the film adaptation of The King and I, from Here to Eternity, and Black Narcissus.
Yes, which is getting a Netflix remake, and I can't wait to cover that on the podcast.
Yeah, it's and this lady, too, also knows Netflix, her sexual repression. FX. Yes.
Is that the other movie about sexual repression that you were referring to?
Jack Clayton did not direct Black Narcissus, but her character is called Miss Giddens. We already described the plot. I guess I just kind of want to now talk more about the film and more so about how this film was shot and overall context and the subtext of this film, because this film is rich with all of that.
Yes. So interesting. I didn't read about the sexual repression.
Mm-hmm.
I actually read this as I thought she was a pedophile.
Oh, that's actually a really good read.
I thought that she was madly in love with Miles. And that's the kiss at the end. We're going to, by the way, guys, so many
spoilers.
We're
going to spoil this.
So if you haven't seen this movie from 1961, this actually will have spoilers for
Bly Manor too.
So FYI, guys, if you haven't finished Bly Manor, finish it, then listen to us. But
still rate us, please. So this film has bookends. It begins and opens with her praying.
Mm-hmm.
So we're setting a couple of things up once. One, religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And anxieties within this character.
Yeah, she's praying that she can save the children. She loves the children.
Instead of hurt them, yes. And then, rewatching it too is great. It goes beautifully. I mean, the cinematography by Freddie Francis, he's a great cinematographer, is astounding in this film.
Yeah, this film is beautifully shot.
If you're interested in cinematography, watch it just to see his stark contrast between foreground and background and the black and white. It's very beautiful.
I know some of those shots I was very much wondering. It's just like, how do they do those back then?
Which adds to the fantastical of it all, Yeah, really impressive stuff. But so she's praying, and then all of a sudden it slowly fades into her being interviewed by the uncle for the job of the governess. And the first question he asks her is, do you have an imagination? And she says yes. Mm-hmm. So, it automatically puts up this whole situation of whether or not we're living in something that this is happening in reality or not.
Correct.
So she comes. She's immediately taken with the two children, Flora and Miles. More so Flora.
Miles isn't even there at the beginning.
Yeah, Miles is not there. He is expelled from boarding school. And, him and the housekeeper, Miss Gross, can't believe it because they've been told, and Gross knows Miles to be an exceptionally nice boy. Mm-hmm. And when he comes, he proves to be that, although there seems to be some immediate tension between Miles and Miss Giddens.
Right. So, and immediately, so he, again, this is, I didn't start talking about it now. It's giving me more red flags. I think she was a pedophile. And yeah. Here's why. Uh-huh. She didn't mind, but she was just taking care of the girl. But when she found out that there was a little boy coming, she panicked. And she was just about to write to the uncle. And, you know, Mrs. Gross was just like, don't bother him. He doesn't like to be bothered. Yeah. I don't do a good British accent. Sorry, guys. I think it's actually a Cockney accent that she had, but I could be mistaken.
A bit of a, yeah. Which we won't do because we don't want to offend the British anymore than we already did.
Yeah, fine. But when she got the letter saying that, like, the kid was expelled, she went into a full-blown panic. And I don't know if she was just being lazy. She didn't want to take care of a second child. That wasn't part of her pay. Or, you know, looking back at it, as I was reading, I'm just like, she wants to diddle this kid, I think.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I wouldn't say that. I remember her being like completely like going into a frenzy when she finds out about the boy, but things automatically shift the moment he's introduced into the household.
I mean, all women are apparent. You know, fanatical and frenzy-ish in my opinion. Yeah. So.
Moving on. Pretty much throughout the whole movie too, just to kind of like sum up the plot here, is that she finds out about the past governess, and I guess, what was Peter Quint? Was he a housekeeper?
He was a valet.
He was a valet.
Yeah, that's what Miss Gross referred to him as. It's like, he was a valet.
So that was pretty good.
Thank you.
So she finds out about the fact that there was a relationship, a sexual relationship between the former Miss Governess, Miss Jessel, and Peter Quint, the valet, and that they both have died.
Can I tell you how much I also love that name? Peter Quint is such a good name.
It is a good name, yeah. It's a very British name, too. I don't know why, but it is.
It's a very sexy name.
Yes.
This Peter Quint was not sexy.
No. Well, we barely saw him.
Every time we saw him, he looked terrifying.
Well, yeah, because he may have been a ghost. But so Miss Gross then informs her about this relationship that they had, and immediately, too, she just is kind of, like, preoccupied with it. And that, too, also, changes her perception of what's going on in the house. And Miss Giddens becomes convinced that there's something wrong with the children and that there are people who are haunting the grounds. At first, she thinks they're people, but then she is convinced that they're spirits who are haunting the grounds, and they are there to possess the children. And she's so preoccupied with this notion that she becomes convinced that she knows how to get rid of them, which is that the children must admit that they are there and they are possessing them. She presses Flora to do this, and she has been told to not mention the passing of Miss Jessel to Flora. So she ignores it, presses Flora for it, and Flora pretty much breaks down.
She goes hysterical. As is the fate of all women, I think, in repressed England. Wasn't that, that's a book, right? Women on the Verge of a Historical Breakdown? Hysterical Breakdown?
There's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
Yeah. Is that not English? Or is that...
No.
No?
No.
That's a
Spanish film.
I'm sorry, the Spanish people go hysterical. My bad.
Yeah, well, Spanish people are very melodramatic.
That's true.
And that's not even like, that's not a bad thing. But but anyway, so when Flora gets taken away because she got put into hysterics by Miss Giddens, she's like, all right, well, now, you know, you go and you see the uncle and leave me alone with Miles, because now I'm going to get it out of him.
Not just that. Well, hang on. Her breakdown is actually even more pointed at. She's like screaming, like, don't you see her? She's over there. And like the audience, do see a woman in the lake, but you know, this girl is swearing that she doesn't. And then Miss Gross comes in and she's all like, girl, are you okay? Are you okay?
Yeah.
In British.
And she was just like, admit it, you saw what I saw. And she's like, no, what you did to Flora was you reminded her of a bad memory. You know, like, she refuses to be like, I saw what you saw. Like, no one can say that they see what Miss Giddens sees.
Correct.
And so she manipulates it to that so that she could be alone with Miles towards the end of the film.
I bet she did.
And when she is, she pretty much does the same thing to him, only to lead him to die. Spoiler, he dies.
All right. That I didn't understand. How did he die?
Well, that's the thing, too. It's not really clear how he dies. You know, there is a moment earlier in the film where he picks up a bird, a pigeon, with a broken neck.
Right.
And that's supposed to be a foreshadowing of him, right? So it seems like something happened with his neck. Now, if the film is telling us the truth, you know, then somehow maybe it was supernatural. But if the film is trying to be, which I think it is, ambiguous, then there could have been some foul play in his death on Ms. Ginnon's part.
But we didn't see the foul play. Unless
we did not see it. No.
So that's where I'm more confused. But I was a little confused by the ending.
Yeah, because he just nothing, all of a sudden...
To say nothing of the kiss. I was already confused. I was already confused up until that part. Then she kisses him and I'm just like, I don't approve.
Yeah. Well, so the kiss at the end of the film is one of great speculation. And, you know, like a lot of essays in film theory have been put upon this. So when you watch this film, you're either on one side. One side is that there was paranormal activity and that the ghosts of Peter Quint and Miss Jessel are either possessing the children or affecting the energy of the people there.
And
the
what's,
other is that...
And I would argue that depending now, if you're watching this nowadays, after Bly Manor... You're going to be on the side of Bly Manor believing that the ghosts are real.
Yeah. Which right? So we're not gonna don't think of this with your watching Bly Manor mindset.
Which is hard for me to do, as you know.
It's really hard, yeah. Well, that's the thing too. Apparently,
as I am notorious for watching things backwards.
This is true, but apparently the Henry James novel itself wants it to be ambiguous.
Okay.
So if you have seen Bly Manor, the Netflix series, it's not ambiguous at all.
No, right. But how is it able to be classified as a ghost story then?
Well, I mean, you can't
have your cake and eat it too.
No, that's not... Well, nobody knows if ghosts are real or not, period.
No, but it'd be like, you can't be in the genre of a ghost story and have it both ways of saying it's just like, but are these ghosts real or not? It's just like, is it a ghost story then or is it not?
No, I disagree, because we don't know whether or not ghosts in general are a real thing. So right. Any ghost story can't say that this is certainly for real, that it's ghosts.
Oh, like, I think see what it works. Mean. Okay. So it's trying to go on that ambiguity of like whether ghosts are real. Okay.
I as a writer cannot say to you ghosts are 100% real. So I'm going to write my story that way.
I don't know. But like as a writer, you get to decide, don't you?
Yeah. But also, don't you think that sometimes films and books leave it up to you kind of do a better job at trying to come across with what they're trying to say?
Not on ideas. Not so much for me for like supernatural stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just like, I think the creator should pick a side and stick to it.
Interesting.
I think when it comes to ethics or morality and stuff, and they want to leave it up to the viewer, that is where you as the audience get to decide. But I don't think on the supernatural stuff, it's the same thing. I don't think it has the same weight.
Well, I think that in this particular case, I kind of enjoyed it because you get to really debate and really read into the lines of what you think is going on. Right. The other side of the story is that you believe that Miss Giddens has all made this up in her head, mm-hmm. and that she is internally and sexually disturbed, maybe, or just like tormented. And OK, you took it to the... to the level that she's a pedophile.
And I don't know why. I just think it was a read I got from her.
But I think that's a good read. It's because I've always thought that this was a story. In my opinion, I'm on the side that this is a story about sexual repression, mm-hmm. that she projected her own sexual repression when, one, she heard the story about Peter Quint and Rebecca Jessel, and she kind of became obsessed with it, right? Yes, and the idea of it. And then she also, with the way that Miles was acting, you know, whether or not he was possessed by a ghost, he was being a little inappropriate, right?
He was, because he did kiss her. There were two open mouth kisses here between a child and a woman. Yeah. The first one he initiated, but I didn't see her back away.
Yeah, she actually, it's this really intense, extreme close-up of their lips, mm-hmm. and she's like trembling, right?
Yes, so it's right, she was. And that's part, I think that was the moment where I was just like, oh, girl here, she is not protesting too much, and that also raises mm-hmm. eyebrows.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah.
It makes you think, what the hell is going on here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, does she enjoy this? So I think a combination of her, you know, preoccupation with that story and just like not being able to get it out of her mind and it literally, you know, haunting her, and Miles acting inappropriate with her, I think that all of this was just a projection of hers and her sexual repression.
Yeah, because
which
it was
also...
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, which is why at the end, you know, it's almost as if she feels the need to, one, be alone with him, and then after, I think she kills him, in my opinion.
Interesting. So, because he knows. He knows that she...
Well, she's like, he's like, woman. You're insane.
Yeah. It was soon after that kiss when she had that, it was like that dream sequence, I guess.
Yeah.
Or that weird montage sequence of like the kids whispering, it's like, it's our secret. It's our secret.
Yeah.
Implying that the secret was between Flora and Miles. However, you know, it could have been like, you know, it's our secret. I'm going to have my way with you. You know what I mean?
It could be. Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that too, is because then also who's talking? There are some people who have the theory that perhaps the kids were already abused sexually by Peter and Miss Jessel. Right.
That's an interesting read. I think that's also a fine read that I want to talk about specifically when we get to Bly Manor.
Ooh, okay.
Okay.
So that's the thing too, that this film, I think a lot of that adds to its cinematography. It's super atmospheric. It's beautiful black and white. It feels claustrophobic. And you know that there is stuff that is boiling underneath.
Yeah. Speaking of black and white, 1961, it didn't have to be black and white, right?
No, yeah, that was definitely a choice.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was a good choice.
I think for horror, sometimes when you do black and white, it's way more effective.
I think part of it too is because it's not contemporary, right? This movie came out in 1961. This is not they're not set in 1961, obviously, right? It also gives it that much more archaic feeling that worked in its benefit, because there were many times when I'm watching, I'm just like forgetting. It's just like, this movie's from 1961, not from the 1920s, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, when this movie came out, it was pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a film that film theorists are really into.
Interesting. Okay. I can see why.
People love to debate about it. And I think it's just overall probably one of the better films about hauntings that has ever come out.
Yeah. So are you in the boat that you think, you mentioned this, so you think it's about the sexual repression?
Yeah.
So you don't think the ghosts were real?
I don't. Okay. Well, also, you know, if you kind of like read into a couple of things, you know, like we see the reflection of Peter Quint on the window, but we only see that after she has shown a picture of him, right? So if had we That's seen his point. Reflection on the, you know, in the window before she was shown a picture of him, then maybe I would think that. But it's like little things like that that I'm like, I think this is all in her head. I think that she's so preoccupied with this, you know?
But she saw a man first before.
Yeah, but it was just a figure. It didn't have a face until she saw his face.
And then it was Miles, because she sees Miles as a man, not a child. Oh, there you go. This just feeds more into my pedophilia theory.
Yeah.
That Deborah Kerr is. Eddie, shockingly, I will say this, despite the movie is disturbing, only, I guess, depending on how you end up reading it.
Yes.
For me, it was disturbing because I thought it was just a predator living amongst these poor kids.
And that is horrifying.
Yes.
There is horror and sexual repression.
Right. But I will say the movie itself is pretty still unnerving.
Yeah.
I would say just because of, you're right, the atmosphere, the camera work, little kids are always creepy also. I mean, you want to scare people, throw little children. Make them British, even extra horrifying, right? Because specifically Flora, I think it's in my notes here. Flora was the first one to ask. It's just like, what happens when we die? Do we just like stick around? And I don't know, if I were the governess, I'd be like, well, I'm going to go. Goodbye.
Yeah, yeah. The one other thing I will say that really adds to the horrifying qualities of this film is the sound design and the music. I think that the sound, especially that moment where she's like, you know, perusing the hallways at night and all of the voices and stuff, they're just like getting to her, and she's beautifully sound designed, and the melody that opens the film that they sing throughout the entire film is so haunting. Mm-hmm. No pun intended, but it is just, and it's such a good melody that Mike Flanagan was like, I'm going to use that in Bly Manor as a nod to The Innocents.
The Weeping Willow?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
So good.
I had a question for you about The Innocents that maybe I was maybe reading too much into it, but who knows?
Let's see if I can
There was
answer.
A quote that the governess said. I think, what was it? Giddens? I kept writing Gibbons in my name. Like the monkey. But no, Miss Giddens. But she says, secrets require a privacy that a little house did not provide. And when she's talking about, you know, that quote caught my attention for some reason. And I think it was because I think that's true. I think rich people are the people who could afford to have secrets. And here she is taking care of this rich. You're also seeing a little bit of, you're not, it's not, you're not seeing class dynamics here very hard, obviously, right? Because you, I think some of the moments that catch my eye was when, you know, the maid, when she admits, I can't read, mom. And
yeah,
you know, I'm
yeah.
just like, oh mm-hmm. my God. And it is like this, I don't know. At the same, like, I don't know. The kids did hold this power as they were the rich ones.
Yes.
Over, you know, even over her, which I think was also playing into that psychosomatic, psychosexual relationship here, right? Mm-hmm. They, you know, the kids, mm-hmm. the kids themselves had the power over her. Like, she is their provider, their caretaker, but, like, they're the ones who can still call the shots.
This is true.
And,
yeah.
you know, you can tell by how they act out sometimes. I'm going to run around. Or it's just like, I'm so sad it's raining. Oh, my God, you know what? It's going to be your birthday now. That was a scene, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and let's do this, let's do that. Yeah, and like, she's like, okay.
Yeah, like, so, I don't know. Maybe, again, this just might be me reading too much into it, but that line I wrote in my notes because I did like it.
No, that's a good read. Mm-hmm. And so you enjoyed this film?
Oh, yeah. This was an enjoyable film. I enjoyed it a lot. And we haven't done a lightning round in a while.
Uh-huh.
So I can't wait to do a lightning round for this one.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the return of the lightning round.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's do that after we get into Netflix's The Haunting of Bly Manor.
So from 1961, we go all the way to 2020. My math is always terrible. That's what, 61 years?
Just about.
Okay. 60, whatever. The point is, it's been a while. And Netflix decided to bring us this wonderful series called A Haunting in Bly Manor, which goes, you know, obviously a different name than The Innocents. However, the Bly Manor is referred to as such in The Innocents.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice. Bly Manor is a story within a story, because the first episode is of Carla Gugino in old makeup as a narrator at a rehearsal dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And after everyone is, you know, a little loose, you know, they're all hanging out, they decide to all sit around a circle talking about ghosts for some reason. I don't remember how the ghosts came up into play.
Who, by the way, just the hottest woman on earth.
Tell me about it.
I mean, yeah, even with the old makeup that they gave her, right?
She's still so stunning.
Distinguished, so
yeah.
captivating.
She's one of the most beautiful people I've ever seen in my life.
I would have definitely sat through that whole story.
Yeah. I just would have stared at her.
I just would have gotten two drinks, though.
So she's telling a story, mm-hmm. and she labels the story as a ghost story.
Yes.
Which is what becomes the rest of the series. And the series follows the au pair, Danny, played by Hilary Duff's little sister. I don't think it's really her little sister.
Oh, I was going to say,
they
what?
Look so much alike. Every time I kept seeing it, I'm just like, oh my God, it's baby Hilary Duff.
Yeah.
She plays Danny. Danny takes on this job as an au pair I forgot the name of the family already.
Wingrave.
Yes, the Wingrave. So she applies for a job she's in England. She's an American in this story.
Yeah, she's an American.
She goes to, I'm the worst at giving summaries because I just like talk all over the place. But so she's an American. She goes. So she's hired to be an au pair. And we come to find out very early on that she herself is haunted by a ghost.
Yeah.
So I was led to believe from the first episode, this is going to be what happens when one haunted person goes into a haunted house. Do these ghosts duke it out? That's what I thought the story was going to be about. And it turns out this was not that. Spoiler alert, guys. This is not really a ghost story. This is more of a love story.
Yes.
That is my summary of the thing.
So actually, her name is Danny Clayton, which is a nice little, one of many, but nice little nod to The Innocents, because the filmmaker of The Innocents is Jack Clayton.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. Use the song and stuff and just other stuff. So when they figured that they were going to do a pretty much a kind of an indirect sequel to The Haunting of Hill House, and they the second edition in this anthology, and they turned to the works of Henry James, they decided to pretty much put a bunch of his stories together into one. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So not only is this the turn of the screw, this is also, and this is funny too, because the names of the episodes are also based are taken from short stories of Henry James, and some of them directly are those. For instance, The Romance of Certain Old Clothes is used heavily as episode 8. Yes. The Jolly the flashback Corner. Episode? Yeah, the flashback episode. That's that's an entirely different Henry James ghost story.
Well, that makes sense because the main story feels a little disconnected from everything.
Yes.
I think it's a good explanation as to how the spell happened, like what the curse is.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what the story was about, it kind of felt like it's just like, wait, in retrospect, what? How?
Yeah.
What is like, happening? Wait,
what? Yeah.
But
it comes completely out of left field. But
I liked it. Like that episode. I thought it was a nice story.
Yeah.
But and it explained to me how the curse happened, and I actually did like the logistics of how this curse came to be.
Mm.
So again, guys, this is going to be heavily spoiler. I don't think we can talk about the show without going into spoilers. So here's a spoiler for that thing. The lady in the lake is the reason that all these ghosts and apparitions happen in the house. She
was the lady of the house.
She was the lady of the house.
Of Bly Manor.
So it turns out anyone who dies in Bly Manor or in the property is stuck. Their spirit is stuck.
And they're condemned there.
As a narrator said it, what happened is death kept coming, like death, the apparition kept coming to the house. However, she was never ready to go, so it just stopped coming altogether. And that's why all these spirits are like stuck here. And one of the side effects of being in the manor too long is memories fade. And as your memories fade, so does your face. So all these ghostly apparitions have like no faces.
Yeah.
Especially the longer that they've been gone. So that's the other creepy factor.
Yeah. Yeah, really creepy. So that is an entirely different ghost story on top of the same exact ghost story from The Innocents.
Right.
Which is, you know, the au pair comes and feels like something's up with these two kids. And it turns out that two people who were in love with each other died on the premise. And their spirit in this series is indeed haunting Bly Manor.
Yes.
It's haunting it big time.
Haunting and possessing.
Haunting and possessing. Yeah. Like, big time. Also, it's really... it's really interesting because they gave Miss Jessel a name this time, and her name is Rebecca. And I just think that's a really nice nod to the book by Daphne du Maurier, which we will be covering soon, called Rebecca.
Was that related to Rebecca?
Well, it's mainly because the book Rebecca is about this woman who lives in the shadow of the woman who died before her. And that's kind of like what Danny is living in the shadow of, Rebecca.
I see.
So I think it's just like another nod to gothic fiction.
I just thought it was a nod to... I also thought of Rebecca, but I don't know the history. I just thought, like, oh, Netflix is doing this a lot, like this vertical integration here. Because I also heard Hannah Groves goes to Paris, and I was just like, Emily goes to Paris. This is another Netflix property. Like when we did Babysitter's Club, and it was like Queer Eye. I was just like, they're doing this. This is on purpose. Yeah. They're trying to manipulate people into like just watching the Netflix ecosystem.
Yeah, probably, yeah. So this series it takes this story of the Turn of the Screw, it expands upon it, puts it in 1987, first of all. It takes some of these characters, like Hannah Gross, and expands it, adds a couple of new characters, and then puts other ghost stories of Henry James into the equation. So it's a lot, okay? It's 9 really detailed episodes that we can't really get too much into detail, but boy, do I recommend it.
Yeah, I really got way too detailed in that episode 8. However, episode 8 is an important episode.
It
kind of gives reason as to why. So actually, I take it back. I know I was complaining before about like how is this all connected, but obviously it's connected because her spell is the reason that all these ghosts exist. And now that love story between these two ghosts, right? Because that's, I don't know, maybe it's not a love story. It's a lust story, possession story.
Possession,
not literally possession, but like possession. And he was very possessive of her. Peter Quince was very possessive of our girl,
Rebecca,
Miss Jessel. I forgot her name was Rebecca. I kept thinking, Miss Jessel.
Yeah.
I think some people, though, do get that confused. They confuse love with possession.
Oh, 100%. That's lust.
Know, so you know, it's that, like, he needed her. Mm-hmm. And then you see in his own flashback, because when you watch it, you keep up with it, but when you have to describe it, it does get confusing. It's like, sometimes there are flashbacks within flashbacks.
Yes.
And then we find out there are flashbacks within dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. This is true.
Yeah.
Or their own little hells that they create for themselves.
No, you're right. They're purgatories. I don't know if it's so interesting, right? I don't think it's because if we had to go by the logic of the curse that was placed upon the spell that was placed upon Blythe Manor, she wasn't in hell. She was in purgatory. She was just stuck in limbo, waiting for just to see her just to see her daughter again. I think everyone else ends up repeating not. Oh, I don't know. They all kept saying, I guess they were all calling it like their worst moments or moments that I interpreted more as like the moments that would lead to their death. So spoiler alert, guys, Hannah is dead. Eddie, you call that pretty early on.
Yeah, we knew something was up when she wouldn't eat.
Oh my God, you guys keep all saying that. I thought she was just trying to keep her proper figure because girl looked great.
I didn't know she was dead, but I knew there was something off about the character.
I wanted to believe that she would be okay because I loved her character so much.
Yeah,
I don't
she was
think
a great character. Yeah,
played by her name Tania. Tania, do you have that?
Tania Miller.
Tania Miller, great actress. If there's a showstopper in this series, it would be her, in my opinion.
It would be episode 5.
Oh, her episode.
It kind of reminded me of one of the Watchmen episodes, where it just kind of like kept going seamlessly, you know, between the past and the present and the future and like how it's all like time doesn't even matter. You know, two really great television episodes that I've seen recently that have both like kind of taken that approach and kept me interested and kept me on the same page with it the entire time.
While giving you lots of exposition at the same time.
A lot of exposition.
Like it's able to deliver all this exposition while still being entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we talked about how some parts of the innocence can be like, you know, a play.
Yes.
This show also has moments like that where all the characters break into monologue at one point or another.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's almost a melodrama.
It is. And I think sometimes it could be distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, if I'm going to be real, I think sometimes it could be just a little bit, it's just like, oh, is this really an appropriate time for a monologue?
Yeah.
So, for example, one of them is when Danny confesses to Jamie about being haunted herself. I feel like Jamie didn't handle that properly. Jamie was a little too cool. Just like, okay, no big deal. So you're haunted by a ghost.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like if Eddie, you told me that, I would be like, okay, and call psychiatric help.
Exactly. It's good to know.
That's good to know. Well, I don't think she believed her at first too. I think it took her a while to like kind of comprehend.
That's true. I guess that's right.
I mean, there's so many. Like, I think Cupid has a permanent residence at Blythe Manor because literally everyone falls in love there. Like everybody.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Rebecca and Peter Quinn. Yeah. Both of the sisters with their cousin. Weird. Back in the day with Viola. And
that wasn't, I mean, it was a distant cousin.
Distant cousin, but still.
And he was rich, so yeah. I approve of that.
Peter Quinn and Rebecca Jessel, Hannah and Owen, Danny
Hannah
and Jamie, and the freaking uncle and the mother, Charlotte. So just
that everybody. Was more lust. That wasn't love.
That was just, no, it, was just it was just everybody's
love.
Banging.
You think it was love?
Yeah.
I don't think it was love.
Yeah, I think it was love.
No, he loved I don't her. Think it's love.
He loved her.
I don't think
he,
oh,
well, I mean, he.
All right, fine. I think he may have loved her, but I think she. I think she still loved her husband, but she was just feeling neglected. I don't think she loved him the same way.
I disagree.
I don't know. Do you? What do you think, Nicole?
I think she loved him. I think that, you know, she loved her family more at the end, which is why she made the choice that she did. But I do think that there was love between them. And I think that's why he was so fucked up from it.
Yeah. And
but I do
his own ghost.
This wants me to talk a little bit about performances for a bit, and I'm gonna have to start with Henry Thomas. You know, I get it that Mike Flanagan has his favorites and he's gonna bring him back, and Henry Thomas is one of them. He was, you know, in Gerald's Game, like Jenny told me, but like, I mean, come on, like that was just the worst British accent I've ever heard. Like,
I actually kept watching it every time he did speak. I actually had this reaction where just like, is this a good accent or is this a bad accent? I honestly can't tell. He confused me, so I can't speak to that because I've been notorious to have bad accents when I need to put on an accent. So somehow they all skew Jamaican. somehow, some way.
This is true. Yeah. Listen to our Departed episode when he tries to do a Boston accent. It's pretty great.
Oh my God. That's right. Yeah. So
memories of
who
that.
Am I to judge?
I mean, but I think that the performances overall were really strong, but I have to say that, you know, unfortunately I'm one of those people where a badly done accent will take me out. Mm-hmm. And as much as
that's fair.
Henry Thomas did a great job, especially, you know, with his shit eating grin episode, it was distracting. Just overpronunciate everything. It's just like,
oh, now that you mentioned it like that, you're right. It's yes. It was a bad accent.
Yeah.
I think it made it more endearing, in my opinion.
I guess. But I will say the standouts for me were Danny and the two children. I thought the acting overall by those three were just outstanding.
Let's talk about the children. Did you know the girl is Peppa Pig?
Oh, really?
She's the voice of Peppa Pig.
Wow.
I know. She's like, we're like standing before child royalty.
Seriously.
In my opinion.
And I mean, I will bow down to her. I think she was fantastic. She broke my heart in so many episodes, and she's just the cutest fucking thing I've ever seen. I think she was so sweet. I mean,
she's
the
so
one episode
creepy.
When she's, no, she's not.
She was so creepy.
No, she's not.
Everything is just
perfectly splendid.
Splendid.
But that was also Miss Jessel who was possessing her at that moment. I mean, when she's like, when you know later on when you watch the show and you know that it's her and she's like, I don't want to play this game anymore. And
was
and
that, wait,
she's
was
tucked
that
in a
Jessel?
Memory.
Jessel was the one who was always splendid?
Yeah, because remember when she came to the grounds, that was the first thing she said. It's perfectly splendid.
I totally missed that. Okay. No, I was curious. I didn't know if that was actually her or I actually weren't. The tells for when Miles is possessed versus Flora.
Yeah. The tells for Miles are way more obvious for when he's possessed.
Because Peter Quince is a dickhead.
Yeah. Yes, he is. But when she's tucked away in a memory, you know, in those moments.
Right. Which are good scenes on her part.
I mean, yeah, absolutely just broke my heart. And at the end, too, you know, when she is essentially, you know, gonna die. I mean, it's just the saddest thing ever. But, you know, Danny comes and Danny saves the day. And
Danny comes and saves the day. And then all of a sudden we find out what this show is really
seriously,
about.
What the show is
hardcore homosexual love. Right?
Like, I mean, Mike Flanagan definitely has an agenda to make sure that there are lesbian stories out there. And I appreciate that.
I wonder why.
Because he probably is, you know, either I know he's not a part of the community, but he's sympathetic to the community and he knows that there should be some quality lesbian stories out there. And I appreciate that.
No shade to him. I love the story. It was a beautiful love story.
Yeah.
I think it was obviously it's a tragic love story by the end of it, but it was like one of those tragedies that didn't feel tragic for the sake of tragic. Does that make sense? Like, I think a lot of... All right, so hear me out.
Interesting. I somewhat agree, but I want to hear you out.
So here's my thing. I think a lot of gay love stories, and it could be lesbian or man-on-man, I think a lot of them suffer tragedy, but that's tragedy from external forces that don't want them to be together. Homophobia.
Forbidden love.
You know, like the family, whatever it might be, right?
Yeah.
This wasn't that kind of a love. This isn't a tragedy from that sense. This is a tragedy of two people who loved each other so much. However, because of external circumstances of, like, you know, supernatural, is the reason that they end up having to be apart. Not just that, the love story is so strong, it's able to break a curse, which I, as far as I can tell, hasn't happened on Disney ever. So points to Mike Flanagan on that one.
This is true, yeah. Well, so the last episode is called The Beast in the Jungle. This is also based on a Henry James story. And that short story is this woman who meets this man who pretty much knows he's going to die. And he spends his life in anticipation of it. And because of it, he doesn't want to make any real, like, life-changing decisions with this woman, right?
Wait, whoa. What? He knows he's going to... We all know we're going to die.
Well, yeah, but he knows it's like... right around the corner. That's what he thinks, right?
Danny is not afraid of dying. She's afraid of not being there anymore.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, so that's a scary fate. Knowing, you know, being afraid of, like, oh my God, my death is around the corner. That's not, anyone can die any moment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This idea of, like, not knowing when one moment you're not dead, you're just not there anymore. That's a terrifying thought, I think.
Yeah, that's
that works for this episode.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, yeah, the short, it's, so it kind of takes liberties with that short story, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it does kind of give it more of a, so the purpose of the Henry James short story was kind of like, don't let the best years of your life go by waiting, you know, for the inevitable, like live in the moment. Right. Whereas I think translated to the Netflix show is that she was able to make the most. She was actually able to make the most. Nobody had to tell her about it. And then when the time came and it was definitely heartbreaking.
It was. Watching the, how we were talking about how the innocence is left for debate, interpretation. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Jesus, I am brain dead today. But how that is left for interpretation. I think you could leave that last scene for interpretation there. Is she there or is that just Jamie's imagination? So that's the other major spoiler, guys. Carly Gugino, I butchered her name, but she is Jamie, which I think, Nicole, you and I had, we were talking about this show as we were watching it. Mm-hmm. And I think I had thrown that out there as a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought correctly. So. Yeah, I was trying to figure out who she was immediately. So.
Yeah, that was who I had guessed. I was just like, she's Jamie. And obviously the older Indian gentleman is Owen.
Yeah. Pretty much she's telling the story back to the people that she experienced it with.
Yeah. However, the kids, because of the events on the property, again, this is about the idea of memory, right? Memories fade. They have no recollection of the hauntings of
Bly Manor. Yeah. And spoiler alert, at the end, that the bride is Flora, who is getting married.
Yes, the bride is Flora.
Really, really touching. Took me by surprise that the last episode was, you know, kind of like couldn't take it almost, you know. It was just so overwhelming. One, because I had never really seen a lesbian story told like this. At least recently, I haven't. And two, it just became a love story from a ghost story.
Yeah. And I think that's what, I think that's also kind of why I did like this love story. Again, I know it's marred in tragedy, right? A person died. However, at the end of the day, if you can take a story like this and it's just, you can still refer to it as a love story, because this is what this is, a love story. Mm-hmm. It's not a gay story. This is not a gay story, right? This is actually just two people who were madly in love with each other and it broke a curse.
Yeah.
I will not forget that. Yeah. And it is a love story. And their homosexuality played no role in it. These are just the characters that happened to be.
You could even say that Hannah's is also a love story, and her love for Owen, you know, how he kind of is what's keeping her grounded. That could be tragic within itself because her soul, move on and accept death. But, you know, it's Owen who's also making her remember herself. You are Hannah Gross. Mm-hmm. You're his 1987. You know, you're with Flora and Miles and all this stuff. And that, like, was when I started crying.
There's no happy endings in the story, really.
Not at all.
But I mean, for Owen and Hannah, I think that was, because I loved their relationship and I was shipping them and I was just like, oh my God, just get together already, crazy two lovebirds.
Yeah, and they never did.
They just couldn't physically.
Her running after him and being like, no, I will go to Paris with you and all this stuff was so sad, you know?
Cause, it was.
Because that's life, you know? Like, these opportunities miss you and then, you know, you try to go after them, but they're gone. And it's so sad.
Yep.
The show gets surprisingly deep.
It does. Yeah. It does.
And it's so funny too, because it's like, you even made me think too. It's like sometimes it's what we do, is we replay these memories and we change the morale.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what if, and I'll remember it this way. I remember that I did say yes, you know, and you play that fantasy out in your head.
Yeah. Yeah. Too. That's how that played for me actually. Yeah.
And that's how this podcast is, because we're constantly revisiting. Oh, Hollywood is constantly revisiting the past and saying, it's like, what if?
Yeah.
What if the Ghostbusters were women?
Although, yes. Yes.
Or now children.
Although I will say the second half of this podcast is nothing like the first half. So maybe we should talk about some of the elements that are very similar to the actual book and movie, The Innocents, which have to do with Peter Quint and Rebecca and Flora and Miles.
The Peter Quint in the mirrors.
Yes. So.
Not mirrors. I'm sorry. Windows.
Windows. Yes. So within the first episode or two, this feels like The Innocents 100%. You know, there's a there's a figure there. You know, you don't know if he's really there or not. They're like, oh my God, is he actually alive? And then we find out the story about Peter Quint and Rebecca, and it actually provides us with their whole backstory and how he was a valet and she came to look over the children. And then it goes into a different kind of realm, because this series decides that they are indeed ghosts that are hunting Bly Manor and the children and trying to possess the children.
Right.
And so that's where it completely differs from it's there's no ambiguity about it. I mean, this is filled with ghosts. In this series, Peter Quint was actually killed by the spirit of Viola, the lady in the lake. And he can't come to terms with the fact that he's dead. And he, you know, doesn't want to live this life. You know, he had other plans for himself. He died abruptly, blah, blah, blah. So he pretty much manipulates. He appears as a ghost to Rebecca and manipulates her to letting him possess her. And when he possesses her, he drowns her body and kills her. And she commits suicide.
What a dick.
First of all, also, rudest thing you could ever do.
Rebecca's kind of stupid.
Yeah, well, she wants the dick. She's not thinking clearly.
I mean, he says, like, I know how to make us equals. I'm like, girl, that only means one. Like, unless he's going to reanimate, there's only one other direction that story can go.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, it does a really good job of, like, showing how, like, a bad relationship and a toxic, lustful relationship can, like, ruin your life.
Really? I don't know. Henry's story, did a pretty good job of that.
Henry's story too. Yeah, it shows what, you know, a healthy relationship looks like and not healthy relationships look like.
The moral of these stories were that the homosexual love wins.
Yeah. Yes. Wave that flag. But yeah, so that's why they're there. So their spirits are not only, you know, trapped because of the curse that Viola put on Bly Manor, but they have all this unfinished business. And throughout the entire series, they keep using Flora and Miles because they actually want to live permanently. This is Peter Quint's idea more so, but they want to live permanently within Flora and Miles.
Right.
And you wanted to say something about that earlier.
I did. I'm just like, so what was their plan? They were just going to be incestuous twins, like, for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, disgusting.
I don't think they thought that out through. Like, I don't know. I know that they're not, because they're technically different spirits in these bodies, but, like, the world will not see it that way. The world... We all could not stand Jaime and Cersei together in Game of Thrones. So, like, we're not going to accept these two little twins having that relationship together when these two ghosts possess them, which was my question. I guess that was also running through my head as I was watching The Innocent.
Yeah.
Because she also had the same theory in which these ghosts are going to possess these kids so they can have their way together. And it's just like, well, girl, that means that you're, like, thinking of incest. That's what you're considering.
Yeah, which is also just also makes her... a really foul brand person.
Right, a little bit.
Yeah, like, what's going on in your head, lady? But that is actually kind of presenting itself as a reality in the Netflix one, which I did think about that too, and I was just like, this is disgusting. Like, this is terrible, and I hope that we don't even get to see this happen.
Now, did you notice all the sexual... There was a lot of sexual... not malfeasance, shit. Sexual abuse. There was sexual abuse, right? So Jaime admitted that she herself had gone through some sexual abuse growing up.
Yeah.
But so did Peter Quint.
Mm-hmm.
Which was another one. And I found that interesting. It's just like, wow, two characters in one home that have sexual abuse. Mike Flanagan, what are you trying to tell us here? Because
I
don't know.
He might be playing off some of the turn of the screw motifs, you think?
Oh, possibly, maybe. In hindsight, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. When I was watching, I'm just like, I don't know. I don't think I know that sexual abuse is not, like, uncommon, but I also don't know. I don't know. I don't feel like people want to be defined by their sexual abuse either.
No, I definitely don't. And I don't think they were. Yeah.
Well, Peter Quint, his moment here is a moment when is related to his sexual trauma.
Yeah,
here.
Which he doesn't even want to. It's almost kind of like this, you know.
No, and he questions that. How come I always keep coming back
to this?
Here,
yeah. Yeah.
To this. And it's also too about it's like. Not, I feel like maybe one of the things is them not being able to resolve whatever issue.
Yes.
Maybe in that moment. Mm-hmm. So they constantly return to it. Maybe a possibility of learning something or making a decision. But I think an interesting thing about comparing having two characters that both experience this kind of abuse also shows, like, they at some point decided to change things around for themselves, for the worse or for the better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what kind of man did Peter become?
Yeah.
What kind of a woman did Jaime become?
Yeah.
You know,
I also read it as guilt for what he was doing to Miles, you know, that he kept revisiting his own trauma because he was now causing it to somebody else, you know.
Interesting.
And that when he died, you know, he looked at Miles and he said, "I'm so sorry." Did I do that good?
That was actually pretty good.
Thank you. Just came out. But it's multi-layered here. And like, you know, not a lot of, I mean, I think this is intended actually on Mike Flanagan's part, but every one of these characters are haunted by something within themselves,
right,
which is also why it's just so rich with, you know, the motifs of memories and haunted and trauma and all of that. So it's really multi-layered. I mean,
yeah,
there's similarities here to The Innocents, and then it takes that and it expands and it goes in a bunch of different directions that nobody sees coming and stuff. So
in a wonderful direction. I think it was really great. Yeah, I think for me, by the end of it, once it became a story, I genuinely do think it's like the moment this turned into the story about like how this this love story was just like, I was just like, shit, you know what? This is it. This is what makes the show fucking great. Like, they told this beautiful 100%. Fucking love story.
Yeah.
And, you know,
they ditched the sexual repression of the original source material.
They did. I think, oh, that's actually a really good point, I guess, because in a way, Dani was sexually repressed most of her life.
She was,
up until this moment.
She was a sexually repressed au pair, but she didn't take it out on those children.
Nor on the valet.
Nor on the valet, yes.
So
I do want to ask, though, you know, watching The Innocents and then watching Haunting of Bly Manor, which I think it's unfair to watch Haunting of Bly Manor and then go back to The Innocents. However, that is how most people will watch it, but
I think so. I would think most.
It is what it is. They're very similar, but they're very different. I mean, can we even compare them? One and two, you know, is this something that we think kind of needed? I don't want to say improvement, but changing. You know, what are your thoughts?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I had to like obviously think about it after I saw The Innocents, because I think The Innocents is actually a really good film and it really does hold up on its own. Mm-hmm. However, obviously, when you're talking about a series, it gives you a lot of room to explore all the characters.
Yeah.
When we're watching The Innocents, we're watching one woman's story. Here, we're obviously watching all these different character stories, all of them suffering through their own trauma, their own memories. And I don't know, it kind of gives it a fuller breath, I think, right?
I think so, yeah.
So, I don't know. I forgot the question already.
did it need changing, or, you know, like, can we compare them?
And I don't think it's fair to compare them. I also don't think it's unfair to compare them, because at the end of the day, like, this is, you know, I know it sounds like a contradiction there, but I think this is a perfect thing of like, I think this is a perfect example of like how you could take a story and go different directions with it.
100%.
While still keeping true overall to like the overall feel of the original.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Again, I don't know the source material, but if you showed me The Innocents first and then I saw Bly Manor, I could have predicted where Bly Manor was going to go. It's vice versa.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Obviously, because that's the way that I saw it. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think Mike Flanagan is a really clever media maker.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he has a lot of respect for The Innocents. And I think somewhere he also knew that, you know, probably the best adaptation of The Turn of the Screw already happened when they made The Innocents. Mm-hmm. So he was also, you know, we're in a postmodern era where we feel like everything's been done, right? Which is why we either are remaking things, but he's taking it a step further and he's like, I can do a remake, but I could also do my own thing. I can be creative with it. And then he chose to make it a whole Henry James universe and then making it this love story that, you know, people in 2020 have kind of never had before. So, you know, he did three things in one, which I think is thinking outside of the box. And I think this is kind of like the future for remakes, reboots, and revivals, where the source material is just the basis for it and that people will be able to grow it from there. And it's really exciting.
I think those have been the properties that we have gravitated the most towards.
100%.
I think one of the prime examples, and you talked about it, you mentioned it before, was The Watchmen.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Where you take this property, it's just like, okay, I already saw this live action adaptation. Like, what could you give me? And then, surprise, rightfully swept the Emmys.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
So there you go.
Yeah. So, I mean, in this sense, this was 100% needed.
Yeah. it was 100% needed. And you know what? Just in time for the October Halloween festivities. Yes.
And, but don't
despite
be...
the fact... Yeah, despite the go fact. Ahead. No, cool. Despite the fact that it's not that scary.
That's what I was going to say. Don't be one of those people who either are going to compare it like episode by episode to Hill House and to be open to the fact that it might not be the scariest. That, like, it's not as scary as you anticipate because you're getting something in exchange for it that's worth it. So you said you wanted to do a lightning round.
I can't wait. Yeah, let's do this lightning round.
Let's we haven't do done it in a while. The return of
lightning round.
We're going to start off with the governess or Danny.
Danny, come on.
You're going Danny. Ooh, I'm actually going governess.
Okay, so it's a tough call. Why do you pick Miss Giddens?
I think she was more proactive than Danny was. Danny was reactive in this in Blind Manor. And after watching The Innocents, there were a lot of action. So even though I think she is cray, because she is.
Totally cray.
However, she did like kind of put forth actions and a plan. It's just like, okay, they're haunted. We have to stop them. She, you know.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
I respected that. And I think as a result, Danny unfortunately was a little too reactive for my liking. Everything was happening to her. She didn't necessarily incite anything. The only thing she incited was the kiss with Jamie.
Well, despite of her being reactive, she didn't send Flora to the hospital with a nervous breakdown. She didn't kill Miles. So
that's a fair point.
So she's fair the pick point. For me. Now let's get to the children. Miles.
Okay, so my Miles is also going to be from The Innocents.
I actually might agree with you. I think the new actor is a great kid actor and he's so adorable, but he wrote that line really well between like, is he possessed? Mm-hmm. Is he just like a gross kid? You know, like what happened to him?
The first one? No, I agree with you. I think he, shorter amount of time, so he had that advantage of like, am I what I'm, you know, he didn't have the baggage of like having that explanation.
Yeah. Yeah.
The new kid did. So
he did.
That's unfortunate for him, but still a good performance on the new Miles part.
Yes. 100%. And now Flora.
I'm going to go with Peppa Pig.
I'm going to go with that actress too. Who's I'm going to give her real name because I think she was just absolutely fantastic. Emily B. Smith, or Amelie B. Smith. You're just fantastic and you're just the cutest thing ever. And
girl, call us.
Yeah.
Big voice. All right. And then what's it called? We'll whistle and you hang up on us. All right.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm referencing?
Yeah. That episode. It's a really, really cute clip. I've seen that. That's like popular on the internet. It's actually it's so really popular, funny. Yeah.
I'm so glad you know.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Gross.
Kind of unfair. I do like the Innocence one. You know, I think that she's just kind of like watching a Miss Giddens go insane. And at the end, she's like, all right, you're batshit crazy, but sure, I'll go along with whatever you're saying. But God, that episode 5 was just killer. And this new Hannah has so much complexity and sadness. And I got to go with the new one.
I'm obviously going to go with new Hannah also. Hannah. But I, you know what? She's just so, I don't use this word often, but she is very breathtaking.
Oh, she is. She's absolutely
She has
stunning.
Such a screen presence, and it just, every time she's on screen, I just could not stop watching her.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
definitely.
Loved her.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right,
so
cool.
Those are the lightning rounds. That's we haven't done it in a while. I was so excited.
Yeah. But, so that's all we wrote on Blind Manor.
Yes.
And The Innocents.
But tell us what you think. Have you guys seen Blind Manor? Do you agree with us? Disagree with us? Have you guys seen The Innocents? And if not, do you plan to watch it after what we've talked about?
It's available on YouTube.
It is available on YouTube. That's how I saw it. I think there's like two different cuts of it. Not two different cuts, but like two different streams of it.
Yeah.
So check it out on YouTube. It is free.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get that many commercials on mine.
I didn't get any on mine.
Oh, great. Lucky you. So, but yeah, let us know what you guys think. You guys can email us. Our email is remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com. You could also hit us up on Instagram. Our Instagram is @remakesrebootsrevivals. Find us on Facebook, Remakes Reboots Revivals. And hit us up on Twitter. I am on Twitter. It is a little more active. Our Twitter is @remakespodcast.
Well, on that note, stay
unoriginal.